Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling a really big subject, social and cultural anthropology. Our main guide is the excellent book, A Very Short Introduction, by John Monahan and Peter Jest.
Yeah, and it's such a critical field, mostly because, well, it's often misunderstood, isn't it? People sometimes think anthropology is just, you know, collecting strange facts about far-off places.
Right, like a list of quirky customs.
Exactly. But it's actually this incredibly powerful intellectual toolkit. It's designed to help us understand the sheer, almost overwhelming diversity of human social life right now, today.
And our mission here really mirrors the book's goal. We're going to use the study of other cultures, things that might seem, well, peculiar or even illogical at first, as a kind of sophisticated mirror. The idea is to shine a light back on our own cultural assumptions, the ones that are often invisible because they just feel like common sense.
That turning the mirror inward, that's absolutely central. The book argues this approach is basically an antidote, a necessary one, to ethnocentrism.
That tendency we all have to see our own way of doing things as the default, maybe even the best way.
Or the only logical way, yeah.
Yeah.
If you can grasp the internal logic of a completely different system, why it makes sense to the people living it, then suddenly you have the tools, the vocabulary, to question the logic of your own system.
Okay, that's a great setup. Let's get into the authors who are guiding us, John Monahan and Peter Jest. They're respected American anthropologists. What gives them the authority for this kind of introduction?
Well, it really comes down to their fieldwork, decades of it, deep, immersive, lived experience. They're not just theorists. They're practitioners of what they call the ethnographer's craft.
Right.
And what's really great is how their specific areas complement each other. They cover two very different parts of the world.
So tell us about Peter Jest first. Where did he focus?
Peter just spent a significant amount of time with the Dudongo people there in eastern Indonesia. His work focused particularly on legal anthropology.
Okay, so how societies handle disputes.
Exactly. How they manage conflict, achieve justice, you know, systems that look very different from Western courts and laws.
Yeah.
He brings that really granular on-the-ground perspective.
And then John Monahan takes us somewhere else entirely.
He does. Over in Mesoamerica. Monahan did extensive field work with Mixtec and Nahua communities in Mexico. His focus was more on things like religion, ethnohistory, and especially economics.
Economics in what sense?
Specifically, how these indigenous communities navigate being caught between their own local traditions and the huge pressures of, well, global capitalism and the state. It's often a really difficult balancing act.
Wow. So putting Southeast Asia and Mesoamerica together, that's powerful. It demonstrates that the core questions anthropology asks and the methods it uses aren't just specific to one region.
Precisely. They work anywhere. It shows their insights are grounded in the sometimes messy reality of actual fieldwork, not just abstract theory. They bridge these incredibly diverse experiences to give the reader this broad comparative picture.
Okay, so let's look at the book itself then. How is it structured? You said it demystifies the field.
Yeah, it moves right past those old stereotypes.
Yeah.
You know, digging up bones or just collecting tribal masks.
Right.
It positions anthropology firmly as a vital social science, one dedicated to understanding the incredibly intricate tapestry of human culture and social organization.
And it tackles that core paradox.
It does. How can human beings be so incredibly diverse culturally, yet biologically, fundamentally unified? Anthropology sees that tension not as a problem, but as its central strength, really.
So how do they draw you into that way of thinking?
Well, they start smart. They challenge you right away with some of these peculiar practices, things that make you go, huh. It's a great hook to spark that necessary curiosity.
Good ghost check.
Exactly. Then they trace the discipline's own history, showing how it moved away from flawed, frankly racist, 19th century ideas about social evolution.
Ranking societies from savage to civilized.
Right, that whole mistaken ladder. They show how the field shifted to a modern approach built on rigorous cultural relativism. And then, once that groundwork is laid,
they give you the toolkit.
That's it. Foundational concepts like culture, society, kinship. And then they zoom out to connect it all to the big issues we all face now, like globalization and inequality.
So the whole journey is about developing this anthropological sensibility.
Yeah, a new lens. A way of seeing the world that makes you question almost everything you take for granted. It's about understanding the full spectrum of human possibilities.
Okay, if the goal is that anthropological sensibility, we need a concrete example. Chapter 1 kicks off with these peculiar practices. What's the key puzzle they use to make our familiar world seem a bit strange?
They use a classic, really foundational example, Azande witchcraft, which was documented brilliantly by Evans Pritchard. So imagine a situation. A granary collapses and injures someone.
Okay.
Our immediate reaction, maybe, is to dismiss the Azande belief that witchcraft caused it as, you know, primitive thinking. We know the physical cause was probably termites, or maybe the structure was just old and rotten.
Right. We look for the physical explanation.
But here's the anthropological insight. The Azande also know about the termites. They understand the physical mechanics perfectly well. Witchcraft, for them, doesn't explain how the granary fell.
So what does it explain?
It explains why it fell at that precise moment, injuring those specific people who happened to be sitting under it. It addresses the coincidence, the misfortune, the why me, why now aspect. Well,
okay, so it's a different kind of causality they're explaining?
Exactly. What looks irrational from the outside is actually a coherent system of thought. It tackles problems like bad luck, coincidence, social tensions manifesting as harm that our science often doesn't or can't address. Uncovering that internal logic is the goal.
That's fascinating. Okay, so if that's the kind of puzzle anthropology tackles, Chapter 2 gets into the method. How do you solve it? But first, you mentioned the discipline had to move past older, discredited ideas.
Oh, absolutely. There was a huge shift away from that 19th century social evolutionism. That correction really came with what's called the Boasian Revolution, led by Franz Boas.
What was his big contribution?
Boas basically argued that you cannot rank cultures on some imaginary ladder. Each culture is the unique product of its own specific history. That's historical particularism. And crucially, you have to study each one on its own terms. That's cultural relativism.
Okay, so understand it from the inside first. How do anthropologists actually do that? It can't just be quick surveys, right?
No way. It demands the core methodology that Malinowski really pioneered, participant observation, meaning you go there, you live there, often for years. You learn the language, you participate in daily life, you build relationships. It's long-term intensive immersion. That's how you gain the emic perspective.
The emic. That's the insider's view, how people themselves see their world.
Precisely. You have to grasp the emic view first, understand their categories, their logic, before you can translate it into the etic framework.
Which is the outsider's analytical view.
Right. The framework the anthropologist uses to compare, contrast, and communicate findings to a wider audience. But that deep immersion, that commitment to the emic, is really what sets anthropology apart from, say, sociology or political science sometimes.
Makes sense. Okay, moving on to Chapter 3. This is where they really define the absolute core concept, culture. And we're not talking high art here, are we?
Definitely not. We're talking about that shared, learned, symbolic system of meanings, the web of understanding that shapes how we perceive reality, how we interact, what we value.
And Monahan and just draw on Clifford Geertz for this.
They do. Geertz gave us that incredibly useful analogy, culture as a text. His idea was that social actions are like sentences or paragraphs in this text.
And the anthropologist's job is to read it.
Yes, but not just read it to perform thick description. That means unpacking all the layers of meaning, the context, the intentions behind an action, because the action itself is often ambiguous.
Or they use the example of a wink, right?
Exactly. The physical act closing one eye is simple. But what does it mean? Is it an involuntary twitch? A flirtatious gesture? A coded signal between conspirators.
The meaning depends entirely on the cultural context, the shared understanding.
Totally. You need that thick description, that understanding of the cultural text to know the difference. The point is, culture isn't just decoration. It fundamentally shapes how we experience and interpret reality itself. It's the map we use to navigate the social world.
Okay, so if culture is the map of meaning, Chapter 5 looks at the roads and connections, kinship and alliance. These seem like natural structures, like family. But anthropology shows there's a social logic underneath.
Oh, absolutely. And this is where Claude Lévi-Strauss comes in with his really powerful argument about the incest taboo.
The rule against marrying, you know, close family, it seems pretty universal. Why?
Lévi-Strauss's structuralist take is kind of mind-bending. He argued the taboo isn't primarily about preventing something like genetic problems, though that might be a consequence.
Okay.
Its main function, its purpose, is positive. It's the absolute cornerstone of human society because it forces exogamy.
marrying out, marrying someone from a different family or group.
Exactly. The taboo isn't just saying don't marry your sister. It's implicitly saying you must give your sister away to someone in another group, and in return, you can receive a wife from them.
Wow. So the incest taboo is basically a cultural command. Go form alliances. Build a bigger society.
That's the core of his argument. By compelling families to exchange partners, daughters, sisters, you weave this larger interdependent social fabric. You turn isolated family units into a cooperative network. It shows how anthropology can take a seemingly simple, even biological-seeming rule and reveal its massive social function.
That's huge. Okay, finally, Chapter 6 discusses a necessary shift in focus for the discipline: globalization and power. Anthropology realized it couldn't just study groups as if they were, like, isolated islands anymore.
Right. That became increasingly impossible and, frankly, irresponsible. It forced the discipline to look critically at its own history, acknowledging that sometimes, in the past, anthropologists had ignored the massive impact of things like colonialism and global capitalism.
So how do they study communities now?
They have to use what's called a political economy approach. Scholars like Eric Wolf really push for this. It means you must understand how local communities like the Dudongo or the Mixtec are deeply, deeply entangled in these larger global historical forces and economic systems.
You can't understand why someone makes a certain decision about farming, for example, without knowing the history of land ownership under colonial rule or the current price of coffee on the global market.
Precisely. It connects the micro level of daily life to the macro level of global history and power. It's essential for a holistic understanding today. Anthropology isn't searching for some mythical, untouched culture anymore. It's analyzing our complex, interconnected reality.
That makes perfect sense. So, looking back across the book, what are the big overarching themes or messages that you think listeners should really take away?
I think the first, and maybe the most profoundly unsettling but also liberating, is the constructed nature of social categories.
Meaning
that so many things we take for granted as natural or just the way things are, like our specific ideas about family, gender roles, what is economic value, even how we perceive time, are actually cultural creations. They're products of history and society, not fixed biological realities.
And that's liberating because...
Because if humans constructed these categories and systems, humans can also change them. It underscores our agency. Our social world isn't set in stone. It's something we actively make and can potentially remake.
Okay, what's the second key theme?
It relates directly back to the method. Cultural relativism as a methodological stance. But we need to be really clear here.
Right, because people sometimes hear relativism and think it means anything goes, morally speaking, if the Azande logic makes sense to them.
That's the crucial distinction Monahan and Jess make. They stress this is methodological relativism, not moral relativism. It's an intellectual tool, a requirement for doing good anthropology.
A tool to do what?
To suspend your own cultural judgments temporarily so that you can genuinely understand another culture's practices and beliefs from their own perspective, within their own context. It's the essential antidote to ethnocentrism. You have to understand before you can evaluate or judge.
Got it. A method, not necessarily a final moral stance. And the third theme.
The third is that enduring commitment to a holistic understanding of human society. Anthropology insists that you can't understand one part of social life, say, economics in isolation.
Everything's connected.
Exactly. Kinship, religion, politics, economics, ritual, they're all interwoven. If you change something in one area, like introducing a new technology, you have to analyze its ripple effects across the whole system. This holistic view stops us from proposing simplistic fixes for complex human problems.
Okay, those are really powerful takeaways. The book also seems full of memorable ways of putting things. Let's touch on a few key ideas, maybe paraphrased, that really capture the book's essence.
Yeah, there are definitely some lines that stick with you. The first one really sums up the goal we talked about earlier. The goal of anthropology is not to make the strange familiar, but to make the familiar strange.
That's it, isn't it? The real power isn't just understanding others. It's using that understanding to turn the critical spotlight back on ourselves, to question our own assumptions that feel so normal they're invisible.
Precisely. Then there's this idea about culture itself. Culture is not something that people have. It is something that people do.
Ah, that shifts it from being like a static object, something you possess.
Like an artifact in a museum case, yeah.
To seeing it as an active process, something that people are constantly creating, negotiating, performing, and changing through their everyday actions and interactions.
Right. Culture is dynamic. It's lived.
Yeah.
And a third one, reflecting that modern focus we discussed. Globalization is not something that happens to people. It is something that people do.
Ooh, I like that. It pushes back against the idea that globalization is just this big, abstract, impersonal force washing over everyone.
Exactly. It reasserts human agency. It reminds us that global processes, even huge ones, are ultimately shaped by human actions, decisions, policies, and consumption patterns. We're not just passive recipients. We're participants, for better or worse.
That's empowering. Okay, let's bring this down to earth. For someone listening, maybe prepping for a project or just trying to navigate our complex world, how is this anthropological perspective actually practical?
It's incredibly practical, actually, in surprising areas. Take international development, for example. Anthropology explains why so many well-intentioned projects, maybe introducing new farming techniques or health initiatives, sometimes fail spectacularly.
Why?
Because the designers didn't do the anthropological homework. They didn't understand the local social organization or existing land rights or maybe the gender roles tied to specific kinds of labor.
Like, I remember reading about a project that introduced a village well with a pump.
Ah, yes, the classic example.
And it failed because fetching water from the old distant source was traditionally women's work, and crucially, it was their main, maybe only socially approved time to gather, talk, and share information away from men.
Exactly. The new, efficient pump, located centrally, inadvertently destroyed a vital social space and network for women. The project failed not because the tech was bad, but because it didn't account for the social system.
So understanding the culture is key to sustainability.
Absolutely. And you see this in other fields, too. Medical anthropology looks at how cultural beliefs about illness, bodies, or trust affect how people interact with doctors or adhere to treatments. User experience, UX design, uses ethnographic methods to see how people actually use technology in their daily lives, not just how engineers assume they'll use it. It leads to better, more intuitive, more culturally sensitive products and services.
And what about just on a personal level, for self-reflection or critical thinking?
I think it offers tremendous tools for intellectual humility, seriously. It helps you recognize that your own deeply held beliefs about success, family, time, politeness, whatever, aren't universal truths. They're products of your specific cultural upbringing.
Which can make you less judgmental.
Hopefully. And certainly a better communicator, especially in diverse workplaces or communities. Understanding that others operate with different cultural maps can prevent a lot of misunderstanding and conflict. It boosts critical thinking because you're constantly questioning assumptions, yours and others.
Thinking back on our discussion, what really resonated with me was that idea that human diversity isn't a flaw or a problem we need to solve. It actually represents a whole range of different valid solutions that cultures have developed over time to deal with universal human challenges, like raising children, resolving conflict, distributing resources, facing mortality.
Yeah.
Realizing that really challenges any lingering idea that there's one single right or best way to organize human life.
I think that's exactly right. And for me, the book's most lasting and ultimately most hopeful insight is that recognition we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
All our social arrangements, from the Azonda understanding of misfortune to our own democratic institutions, are cultural constructions.
Built by humans.
Built by humans. Yeah. And that recognition is profoundly empowering. I mean, social problems, inequalities, injustices, they aren't immutable laws of nature. They are products of cultural and historical processes. And because of that, they can potentially be addressed through cultural change, social innovation, and collective human action. It leaves you with a sense of possibility.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.